This is the Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by Search Security. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the landmark 75th episode in a series of interviews with security gurus, and we're producing video as well as recording this podcast. You can find the video on the Silver Bullet website. I'm super pleased to have with me today Howard Schmidt. Hi, Howard.
Hey, Gary. Thanks very much.
I'm glad you're here. Thanks for joining us. Howard Schmidt was the cybersecurity coordinator of the Obama administration until last week. Prior to joining the Obama administration, Howard served as president of the Information Security Forum and CEO of R&H Security Consulting, which he founded in 2005. He was also president of the ISSA, a board member of Codenomicon, a board member of Fortify, where I first met him, and a board member of ISC Squared. Schmidt also has been CSO of Microsoft and CISO of eBay. He served as vice chair of President Bush's President's Critical Infrastructure Protection Board and special advisor for cyberspace security to the White House. Howard started his career in the Air Force and was also a policeman in Chandler, Arizona. He has a BS in business and an MA in management from the University of Phoenix. When he's not in Washington, D.C., he can be found in the other Washington or on his Harley somewhere in between. Howard has more grandchildren than you can shake a stick at, including a brand new one. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, it's my pleasure. Thanks so much. And I call it the real Washington.
There you go. That seems fair. Yeah. So you've been in the public sector and in the private sector as a security executive. And I kind of want to know, what are the pros and cons of both? You know, which one's harder? Which one's easier? What are the challenges?
I think what I like to do is probably reduce that to the things that are the same. Because it's interesting, over the years, I'll have people come and say, well, I'm doing a book on government security for information security specifically. I'm doing one for the private sector and want to get your thoughts on that. And the bottom line was, when you look at the evolution of ICT systems, which is sort of the international term we use, they've all evolved from somebody saying, oh, gee, we need something to supplement a business unit, so let's put on a VPN connected to the back-end network. Oh, we need a mail server over here. We need some web services over here. So they all sort of build the same way, whether you're in the government or you're in the private sector. The other commonality is, as this transition was taking place, a revolution was taking place, there was not many people sitting around that says, really great technology. It really gives our customers ability to do great stuff, gives us ability to generate revenue on the government side, gives our customers great experience, have the ability to spend some of the revenue, but also make a better experience for the taxpayers. So that's the same concept. But in between, nobody was saying, well, yeah, that's great, but how do we make these secure? How do we use these to protect privacy?
Right.
So after this has all been built, it's like, oh, wait a minute. People actually are doing things that we didn't think about them doing. Now we have to go back and fix that.
So adoption was incredibly fast in both sectors.
That's absolutely, and it continues to be, by the way. And hopefully we'll talk a little bit about, you know, bring your own device and mobile devices and things. And we see the same thing now.
We just did it.
Yeah, we just did. Yeah, we got that into it. But going back to the things that are very much common, you know, are the things that basically caused us to build this. The things that are somewhat different, and that's the speed by which people react to some of the things we see take place.
Right.
In a corporation, for example, and recognize that the size of the big public's publicly held companies are different than small private companies but the vulnerabilities still exist. So to get a large company that says, hey, I'm really concerned about this. I saw my competitor over there get hacked, get intruded upon, get a DDoS attack, whatever the circumstances may be, the CEO will say, could that happen to us? If so, how do we fix it?
Right.
But that takes planning.
And then something happens when the CEO says that, right? Pretty quickly.
And that's generally the case. Yeah. You know, you have this combination of forces between the CEO and the board of directors.
Yep.
I'm a firm believer the board of directors have a lot more clout than just looking at the quarterly reports and the sales reports. There's got to be a part of this.
I agree with you.
Thank you. on the public sector side, it's different. Up until recently, the public sector is oftentimes, the systems have been viewed as almost individual companies. Mm-hmm. They sort of do their own thing. They have, well, there's meetings. There was a law put together a number of years back that created a CIO council. Mm-hmm. But that was about providing the services and do security. And so we've sort of seen the need to flip that around on its head for the government side, have it more organized, more structured, and basically go at this as, how do we reduce the vulnerabilities? How do we build for the future? How do we do strong authentication? Those are some of the unique things that we see.
Yeah, you know, what's interesting is if you look at technology adoption over the last 100 years, right, this curve of technology adoption for the internet and for mobile devices is incredibly steep. Whereas the curve for electricity and telephone, right, although it was steep, boy, it took, you know, maybe 20, 25 years for it to sink into everybody using it. That gave us some time to get used to it as a culture, but we don't have that time. Now, in internet speed, it's just faster than ever.
Well, you're correct. And I think that's one of the things when you start looking sort of the bigger technologies like supercomputing, those sort of things, just what you would need to generate the power to fire up one of those,
right,
things. I mean, that's what we use sometimes now to power a small city.
Right.
So as a consequence, we have to sort of look at the critical infrastructure, the core resources, as it supports the technology.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. So I want to dive into the private sector first and just say, sure, Microsoft versus eBay. You did both. Different cultures?
Very much different cultures in one sense and one sense only. In Microsoft, it was about creating really great stuff for the masses. Mm-hmm. The eBay experience was the flipping that around. It was the customers that basically were building the company.
Right.
Because I think when I was there, and I forget the number, but it was somewhere in excess of 130 million customers, mm-hmm, just in North America. So as a consequence, that's different than selling software to an enterprise,
yeah,
to run their business.
Sort of crowdsourcing.
In some senses, it was, and it's really interesting when you start looking at some of the things we went through after the acquisition of PayPal. Mm-hmm. You start looking at bringing together security teams and sitting there with the great technologists, great building all this great stuff, and say, "Hey, that's really great. Here's how we can make it secure while doing it, which better protects the customer."
The PayPal guys had a pretty good handle on that.
They do, and that's one of the things when, of course, Michael Barrett went over there from American Express. Mm-hmm. I was really happy to see that because PayPal had just been part of the acquisitions and was just sort of being integrated into the company overall.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that which is really interesting that's a distinction between the two is the on the consumer side, this was back in the day when phishing emails were just becoming,
right,
popular.
Right.
I mean, so it wasn't, some people knew, some people didn't, but the bottom line is it was a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people that fell victim to it said, "Well, you guys need to do more to protect me."
Yeah, it's your fault.
That's somehow correct.
Yeah.
And it's clearly it wasn't.
Yeah.
So it became sort of flipping it around where there was an education requirement to get your customers more aware, better protected, that they needed to do themselves, in addition to the business model that, you know, you post things, you sell things.
Mm-hmm. So same question, but for the public sector.
Right.
Police department versus the White House.
Yeah. And it's interesting. That's quite a jump. I mean, one of them is a local city. I think the simplest thing to say, in the police department, uh-huh, and you look at law enforcement not only around the United States but around the world, and you have people that have to deal with crimes against persons, crimes against property, dealing with somebody's barking dog. And at the same time, in the constantly digital world that we live in, oftentimes the evidence of some of these crimes are found on a mobile device, on a computer, or
yeah, that's what got you started, right?
That's absolutely correct.
Yep.
And that's sort of got me focused on the security side of things. I've always been a technologist. I built my first radio when I was probably 17 years old for my ham radio,
mm-hmm,
built my first computer in the 70s. So the technology's always been there, but how do you marry it up from a security perspective?
Right.
So the police department and any other police department, it's about investigating things and trying to do some level of crime prevention as you're going through that.
Mm-hmm.
The White House, obviously, you have a set of constituents that are just unbelievable.
Yeah.
You have the executive branch, the departments and agencies. You have the legislative branch, which we've had a lot of meetings with over the years.
Yeah.
You look at the judiciary branch, which once again is not a direct one-on-one relationship, but clearly decisions that made in the judicial sector mean an awful lot to how you develop policy, how executive branch executes. So there's a lot of pieces in that that take place. You expand that out to the international footprint. So not only are you dealing with the technology of securing things, but you're looking at international policies.
Oh, and different norms.
That's correct.
And you said you were just in Moscow, and talk about different norms when it comes to computer security.
Yeah, and that's the thing. How do you harmonize those things? Because what we cherish here as a First Amendment free speech issue, other countries said, oh, not so fast. I mean, that could be seen as speech against the country.
Right.
So those are the things you have to deal with. On top of that, when you start looking at supporting the critical infrastructure, you know, it varies. People think of, you know, the people always talk about the power grid, and it's like this one big
thing,
wire that's run everywhere, and people sort of tap off of it. It's small companies, it's medium-sized companies, it's large companies, it's generating plants, it's all kinds of these different pieces.
It's a patchwork, for sure.
That's correct.
Kind of like a quilt.
That's correct. And so the idea of saying, well, you guys go do something, whatever something may be, depending upon their maturity model, that's not going to happen. And then complicating that even further is the whole issue of industrial control systems, digital control systems, SCADA systems, call it what you may.
And they have a very long capitalization period. You know, I spoke with a group of control systems engineers about BSIM and about catching up and about how fast things were going. And they said, hey, that's all great, but you know, we already spent our capital budget and we have 9 years to go before we can replace our computers. And you just go, whoa, that's...
You're right, and it's really interesting because a lot of people don't understand the impact it would be on you and me and everybody, our family members, our friends, because if you were to change that model and all of a sudden say, okay, you have to go out there now and retrofit everything, because these devices originally were not designed to work in a networked environment.
Yeah.
Those that were designed in a network environment that was not connected to the internet. So to rip everything out and replace it, the number is just staggering. I can't even begin how you would estimate it.
Yeah.
But in order, if you were to do that, then what's going to happen to our electricity bill, our services that we use electricity? So there
well,
has
the Dell guys say it'd be cheaper.
Yeah, I don't know about that. But the bottom line is there's a cost to doing it. And you sort of have to weigh that.
Yeah.
You have to do that risk management.
So controversial point, a little
okay.
bit. Everybody says public-private partnership, all these P's, a lot of alliteration. Do you think that that really works, this public-private partnership? What's your opinion on that, having lived in the middle of it?
Well, it is interesting because I think back to 1998 when President Clinton publicly released Presidential Decision Directive number 63. It was during a graduation speech at the Naval Academy and talked about, one, the government wasn't organized. Two, private sector wasn't organized amongst themselves. And the third thing, voluntarily encouraged private sector to create information sharing analysis centers or ISACs.
Yep.
Financial service, the first one that got in there. I was fortunate to work with a great team of people to create the first IT ISAC. Back then, we weren't quite sure. We knew we'd have meetings with the government. We knew we would share information for threats, vulnerabilities, and best practices against amongst ourselves. But our companies weren't even engaged in that. It was the security professional, the security professional.
I
yeah,
know.
You remember the day.
We shared a lot of cocktails, too.
That's absolutely correct. And it was like, well, don't want our business people to find out we're talking.
But you know what was good? You could pick up the phone and call your counterpart because you'd met them.
That's correct.
Right.
Absolutely correct. And that's where the, you know, birds of the feather sessions really made a big difference. So if you look at the evolution of that, and then there was this sort of I call it a dry period, where the private-public partnership was all about having meetings and saying, gee, we have problems, this could cause this, here's cascading effects, somebody go fix it. As a consequence, I think we matured a lot more since that time.
Mm-hmm.
So when you look at what the private-public partnership has evolved to, I think one of the things that's really been helpful in the past is private sector saying, here's the things that we can do now that are fundamentally part of our business model.
Uh-huh.
Here's the things that we're working on, and here's how long it's going to take us to do that. The government says, gee, here's the things we need you to do now. And the government says, here's what you need to do in the future, and to sort of reconcile those. And it will never, ever, ever be a complete 3D overlay that says, yep, you're doing the things that we need you to do. It's going to be a matter of negotiating.
Well, it's always constant catch-up.
That's
know, it's
absolutely
like
correct.
Train cars that are coupled.
That's correct.
So I have a little worry about that, though, because in my view, the government is pretty far behind the private sector when it comes to building security in software security type stuff. And so, you know, what do you think about, in general, the state of computer security in the government writ large? I know we have some super specialist divisions, and I also have an inkling that we're pretty good at offense, but I worry more about the building security engineering type sort of thing.
Well, and you're worried, I'm worried. There's a lot of people worried about how do you maximize the expertise that you have. This has been an ongoing thing. We have tremendous talent within the government, particularly the CISOs that are out there, but they're in high demand. Mm-hmm. They oftentimes have inherited something that was never designed for a small team to secure, so they don't have the ability not only to make sure they're taking care of the day-to-day activities while building for the future. So there's that talent shortage.
Yeah.
The second thing is in private sector. Private sector will walk in and have somebody that's got a couple young kids that they have to worry about college in the future. So there's a fair amount of turnover. The saving grace is right now there's better organization within the government. So you can really do a better job now about leveraging the great expertise you have without leaving a big hole someplace else.
You think? So you know, having looked at firms as diverse as financial services firms and the ISVs like that we were talking about before, there's even a difference between those firms in terms of, you know, maturity when it comes to software security. And I just can't even get the government to say, well, who's doing it? Like, who can I even talk to about the BSIM? And that worries me. Should I not be that worried?
Well, yes, you should always be worried. We should be worried because, number one, we're security professionals, and two, it's about risk management. Mm-hmm. But specifically on software security, you look at the whole soup to nuts of software that we have out there, whether it's an operating system, whether it's a network operating system, whether it's an app that tells you the weather. Mm-hmm. All these things basically are put out because they do something really cool.
Mm-hmm. Functionality.
Makes money. That's right. And so you really have to make sure that part of the requirements, and this is what they started when I was still with the government, go out there and say, okay, we want to buy this calendaring program. Mm-hmm. With that, not only give us these 20 items of functionality, but here's all the things you need to do. You need to do source code analysis. You need to do check the binaries when you've done compiling them. Those are some of the things that people are beginning to move into, but don't forget, we've been doing this for 25, 30 years now. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of catch up in that area.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We'll be right back after this message. This is Gary McGraw, your host for the Silver Bullet Security Podcast. If you like what you're hearing here, you should check out my monthly security column published by Search Security and Information Security Magazine. You can find the most recent column at searchsecurity.com/McGraw. All of my writings are collected on my webpage at www.sigital.com/gem/writings. Thanks for listening. So, as a law enforcement officer, you saw cybercrime and kind of interposed with real world crime firsthand. So, shouldn't we focus more attention on cybercrime than we do on cyber war? Seems like Washington's all excited about cyber war.
Yeah, and I think it's a long-term belief that many of us have had. There's two pieces of crime, and the same things apply in cybercrime. You want to make sure you're doing crime prevention. Mm-hmm. And our earlier illustration where people didn't know that when they got that email that was a bad thing to click that.
Phishing.
You teach them how to do that. Therefore, there's less victims. If there's less victim, the limited resources that are available in law enforcement, whether it's a small city, whether it's a county, whether it's a state, whether it's a federal agency or even international, you have less victims. They have more ability to put the right people on it. Mm-hmm. But when you start looking at resource development, you know, it's hard to really measure it because a lot of people don't report it.
Right.
Companies don't report it. So how do you build the cadre? I've seen in the federal sector, FBI, Secret Service specifically, have not only put the people through the training, hired the people that already had the training, mm-hmm. and building the cadre, but there's only so many resources you can apply in the country, which is why it goes back to your question. If we can focus more on reducing the vulnerabilities, reduce the number of victims, some of the more big ticket items, as when we're looking at military conflicts, will be less likely to be successful because we don't have victims out there.
Right. So actually, I want to give a little shout out to the Secret Service, who I think in terms of law enforcement in cybersecurity are orders of magnitude better than anybody else. They're just very good.
Yeah, and I agree, and a shout out to all law enforcement. I know I've worked very closely during the past 2.5 years with the FBI and the Secret Service. I've had people detailed in from both, tremendously talented, and the big thing that helps all of us as citizens, they're working very closely together to sort of, you know, decide, is this really a financial crime, or is this something more nefarious?
Right, it's tricky.
It is.
It's hard to tell.
Right.
So how involved was the administration, or is the administration, in counter-espionage type stuff, in cyber espionage, which, you know, it's not as big a story as cyber war, but certainly we had some issues with the Google hacks and so on.
Well, I think the government's always concerned about it from a whole different number of layers. If you look at sort of the one end of the box is the cyber crime. You look at the other side of it is the espionage that is going on since governments have existed. Those are sort of the boundaries we work with. So one of the things that when I was with the government, what we were focused on is the theft of intellectual property. Mm-hmm. You know, what are the things that are going in there that basically may not surface as far as the negative aspects of it for 10 years down the road.
Yeah.
So how do we
design documentation?
Design documents, whether it's aircraft, yeah, whether it's software, whether it's the next great technology for mobile devices. Mm-hmm. It's really tough to do that, and particularly since the vast majority of that's generated by private sector, small startups, medium-sized companies. So there's some real concerns about that. So I know, you know, obviously I'm not speaking for the government, but when the government looks at the whole piece of intelligence gathering, whether it's for commercial or government purposes, there's a lot of attention that needs to be applied to that.
Uh-huh. But if you had to rank the three, cybercrime, cyber espionage, cyber war?
Yeah, well, of course, you've heard a long time what we've said about cyber war.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just a term that's convenient for people to use.
Yeah.
It doesn't necessarily reflect what is reality. Also, in any time you're having a conflict, communications, command and control is a core piece of that.
Right.
So it goes back to the old days when people were climbing up telephone poles and clipping the wires.
And,
you know, it's the same thing. So that command and control using cyber technology during a conflict, I mean, that's reasonable. Anybody would expect to want to do that. I think cybercrime is a major, major issue, but pretty much the theft of intellectual property is still a crime no matter what. So
right.
It's hard to sort of stack
rank
them.
It is. Well, I wanted to say thank you for your service to the nation.
Pleasure.
Believe it or not, you took a thankless job that was at the same time critically important, and I think somebody termed it best when they called it the cyber bag holder in chief. So does the shift of your position to Michael Daniel, who's a member of the intelligence community, seem like the right way to go here?
Well, there's a couple things. Number one, Michael's a great guy. And I see this almost like with a startup. You start out with sort of the entrepreneurial-minded CEO that comes in and just, you know, takes something and sort of gets it up to a good start. But then you generally turn it over to a business guy to run the company, make it build. And I see that sort of this transition.
I see.
You see
him as kind of an ops guy?
That's correct. He's the guy that will build the next generation of it. We had to do some of the basic block and tackling. I mean, that was one of the things that was important. We had tremendous talent over the past 2.5 years that were detailed into the organization. People from law enforcement, people from intelligence, people from Homeland, FTC, Commerce, people with great expertise. And so Michael now has the ability and the expertise and the intellectual capital to take that to the next level. So I don't see anything changing. Just like all I was doing was helping to guide the ship. I'm not the one that barks out orders. The concept people have said, you know, the cyber czar. We don't have czars in this country. I was a coordinator. My job was to get all the smart people together, talking amongst themselves, and figure out solutions.
Right. You reported to the National Security Advisor with a dotted line to the National Economic Council, which was an interesting kerfuffle in the beginning. Did that work?
It did. And that's one of the things that I think really put things in a different level when we started putting this office together. You can't just do national security and ignore the economic impact.
Mm-hmm.
You can't do the economic and trade without, you know, taking into account the national security side of it. So the ability to be dual-hatted, to be able to sit there in a meeting and says, great idea, this will make us more secure, mm-hmm. but here's the negative impact on the economy. Here's the negative impact on business relationship. Here's the negative impact on international trade. To bring these together and get people thinking about this with the backing of the National Security Advisor, the National Economic Advisor, and ultimately the President.
So it brings more kind of points of view to bear.
That's correct. And that's what this was all about. It's not about, you know, sort of imposing your will on somebody who says, go do this. It was about how do we solve this really, really complex problem by getting all the smart people together and figuring out a consensus to the extent that we can, a way to move forward.
Mm-hmm. I guess it's partially getting your hands around the threat, too. Right, because if you look at it from an intelligence perspective, a threat may seem completely different than if you look at it through an economic lens.
That's correct. And going back to our earlier discussion about commonalities, when you look at the threat traditionally is extremely successful because of the vulnerabilities that we exist, mm-hmm. and that's one of the challenges. So, what I've been told by really sharp people that about 80 to 85% of the successful intrusions and subsequent exfiltration of data have occurred because somebody wasn't doing the basic good hygiene.
Mm-hmm.
So if we could collapse that down a little bit, then those really hardcore threats that we need to worry about from a national security, national economic perspective, we get a better handle on those.
Let's talk about one of those that's tricky. So what are the main security challenges that a government faces when they're dealing with a threat like Anonymous?
So when you start looking at any group that basically looks to become a hacktivist, is the term that we've used for years and years and years,
right.
You look at their motivation, you have to sit there and say, well, wait a minute, that's the same things that basically are oftentimes are constitutionally protected with one exception. When you start committing crimes to do it, that's a different scenario that you deal with.
Right.
So when you start looking at
that's right, the freedom of your swinging your fist ends at my nose, something like that.
Well, yeah, see, that makes a difference. You know, it's just like we have freedom of speech, but you know, it's not free enough to yell fire in a crowded theater.
Right.
Those things have been worked out in the physical world. But when you start getting into the online world and you look at the internet very broadly, that's one of the many ways people get their voices heard. Mm-hmm. Once again, it should not be committing crimes. It should not be hurting individuals mm-hmm. because there's a lot of cascading effects in it. But when you start looking at what could happen to government operations that provide services to people, for example, a DDoS attack on a particular government website that people are waiting for their paychecks or their, there's a lot of things in there that have cascading effects that I think anybody that looks to affect a system doesn't really think through what's going to be the person
what's
I think
the
I'm trying
downside,
to help. What's
right.
the downside of that?
Right.
And
it's the difference between having an adult dialogue when you have a difference of opinion and having a childlike dialogue when you have a difference of opinion.
And that's a perfect description because I think back, it was 1972. I found the picture when I was moving. I was at Osan, Korea with the Air Force, and there's a picture of me with my hair combed in the middle and down the sides with a base commander, and we're all carrying pictures of Martin Luther King.
Uh-huh.
It was 1972. We were on a military base doing a march in memory of Dr. King. But when you start looking behind the scenes, there was a lot of things that happened that led up to that
right,
piece,
right.
which basically weren't good. Including people being injured, all these other things. But it got us to a point where we were more cognizant of the way we should act as a society. And I think at some point we'll get a better handle of the way we need to act on online.
Mm-hmm.
And it's new enough that we haven't had societies growing up with this as we've had in some of the physical world.
Well, Bruce and I were talking about that, Bruce Schneier, on the last episode of Silver Bullet. And, you know, we were talking about his economic theory and this idea of having radical things that move the system in the right way. Kind of like a parasite, I suppose. I think that's what you're talking about.
Yeah, and parasite also generally has a negative connotation. And if you look at it in a very generic sense, it just seems to move through something. And
parasites
cause change.
Are kind of important, though, in evolution.
That's true. And that's true, because you look at some of the reasons, some of the animals, some of the things we do. So I agree. But indeed, we have to be focused on the broader picture and what changes need to be made to reduce the likelihood of we're going to be creating a society of people that are not feeling part of the system.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So what can we do? This is sort of a gear shift. What can we do to shift the government away from computer security as a compliance right. exercise that really amounts to a bunch of box checking?
Right.
You know, some people like Anoop Ghosh, have criticized the government and said there's a lost decade of computer security. And, you know, the 10 years since 9/11, what have we really done to secure besides just check a bunch of boxes? I'm not sure I share that radical belief.
Right.
But I do think that the basic government approach these days is compliance driven. What's your opinion about all that?
Well, I don't agree with that totally, because there is a compliance component which is created by Congress in a law called FISMA, the Federal Right. Information Security Management Act, that Right. says you must do this. So what we were able to do, once again, back when I was at the White House, with Anish Chopra, who was this former CTO, mm-hmm. Vivek Kundra, who has since been replaced by Steve Van Roekel, that said, wait a minute. This idea of checking the boxes, creating a mound of paperwork, and the terms that we've used for years have said you can be FISMA compliant and still be insecure.
Yeah, right.
Flipping that around. Yeah. By becoming secure, you become FISMA compliant.
Yeah, so it's a side effect.
That's correct.
So does FedRAMP move in that direction?
FedRAMP moves in that area. Continuous monitoring, TIC, trusted internet connections, HSPD 12, the use of strong authentication. We actually had this cross-agency goal working group that basically said, here's the things that can make the change now while we continue to build for the future. So if you look at those three areas, it moves away. Continuous monitoring is a classic example. Mm-hmm. You're not going back and say, yeah, we've had vulnerabilities for 6 months. Why, this is why we've lost something. You find it near real time, dashboard style, and says, let's get it fixed before it has a negative effect. You become compliant. You make the systems better. Your customers have a better experience. Your end users have a better experience. It's a win-win across the board.
By the way, this compliance thing is not only about the government. There are also some industry standards like
right.
PCI,
right.
which, you know, if you turned them around the way you were talking about, might actually be useful, but sometimes instead just amount to pretend security or making people feel like they're secure because they said they were.
Yeah, and that's correct. And that's where we start looking at some of the ISOs, the 27000 series, for example, PCI standards. SEC has recently came out with some guidelines that says even for your filings, you have to take into account cybersecurity issues yep. and the value of the company. So as a consequence, you have to have that mindset that says, great stuff, we're going to provide it, but we're going to provide it securely and protecting privacy. And we haven't even talked about the whole privacy component.
Well, let's do it.
Well, privacy and security are two sides of the same coin. Uh-huh. Because without security, you have no privacy. I mean, the data's gone to whomever. The second piece of this, when you start looking at data protection and the compliance piece. So if you own a business and you tell me as your customer that all I need is one time your information says you're credit worthy, you're really who you say you are, you pay your bills on time, and you have that to validate to me, and I'm going to sell you something, I'm not going to keep that stuff for you, mm-hmm. Which is what's happening today. I mean, there's so much data out there. I jokingly used
it's
to say.
It's a sea.
That's correct. I used to joke before I went back to the government that we should just create a law that says everybody's Social Security number would be publicly available, and then at the same time say they're not used for identification.
Right.
Let's redo the system.
We could do that with credit card numbers too. I think so many have been stolen. There's only six or seven that haven't been stolen. Might as well just publish those and get it over with.
Yeah. And so you look, and once again, I remember we were working on the National Strategy for Trusted Identities in Cyberspace, creating an ecosystem that takes all the stuff that we've learned over the years and says, don't do that anymore.
So what about anonymity? What about trying to remain anonymous when strong credentialing is the norm?
Yeah, and that's a couple key things. One, the strong credentialing has to be by choice, because I think to Arab Spring last year, I think what goes on a day-to-day basis where people want to publish things and should be able to publish things that in other people's minds are controversial.
Right.
And they should still be able to do that anonymously. But they also want to make sure if they're booking a trip and they can choose to use a separate credential for that that's not tied to their anonymous credential.
Yeah, that's tricky.
It is. It's very tricky.
And when we set up strong credentialing for maybe travel reasons, we have the challenge of regimes that have a different approach
Absolutely.
To controlling their populations than we do. And I think we have to be cognizant of that as Americans, you know, to try to spread not only the technology but also the norms that go with them.
And you're absolutely correct. And that starts when we look in outside air. So there's a government-to-government relationship takes place. Many of the countries that operate, that, you know, there would be some concerns about, are you really protecting privacy? You're really preserving my free speech, my ability to communicate?
Right.
So the government has to do that. But also businesses that operate in those countries say, well, wait a minute now. I want to participate. I want to have your citizens as customers. I want to contribute to your economy,
right,
but not at the cost of freedom of speech and freedom of expression and those other sort of things.
Yeah, it'll be tricky.
It is.
We live in interesting times. It's the Chinese curse.
We do, and that's why we're having this, so you can help us design our way out of this.
So I'm optimistic that we've made great progress in software security in the last 10 years, especially in the private sector. And the financial services guys, the ISVs, they've spent a lot of time working on this problem, and I think making some good headroads. So do you share that optimism, that sense that we're moving forward in security, or are you one of those security guys who's been doing it forever and just go, oh, the whole thing is a disaster?
I've been criticized for being the optimal optimist.
I think there are two of us.
Yeah, and there has to be, because we shouldn't be doing it if we think, hey, it's all over, throw up our hands and just go home.
Right.
I have, like you, watched the evolution of software. Watch it from just throw it out there, and if it doesn't work, we'll fix it again later on, but mm-hmm. not much attention paid to security. It's far from perfect. We're still seeing old things like buffer overruns and libraries that were out there 10 years ago being compiled, but we're much better. There's a defined process on how to do this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you've written about it. There's a lot of people have written about it. Mm-hmm. And so it's basically a new generation of growing up that says, I'm going to develop the next really, really cool app that protects privacy and is secure at the same time. That is possible, and that's why I'm so optimistic.
Cool. So now the flyer question. Tell us about your Harley and your next trip coming up.
The next trip coming up, I just had the long one from D.C. to our home in Milwaukee, through tornadoes and heavy rains, and something I'm not used to experiencing, including, I think up to now, my longest trip in the saddle has been about 5.5-6 hours. This was a total of about 16 hours in the saddle.
Holy cow.
Which was great. The next big one will be sometime in August, probably going from the real Washington, my home state, probably across to Oregon and come back up through Oregon and back over there.
Cool.
Beautiful country, great time to ride.
You going to do the Columbia River Gorge?
Matter of fact, probably not. I did that once already, and so we're going to take a different route on this.
Okay.
But it's great. And you know, the people that sort of live this sort of Harley Davidson motorcycle, I don't even have to make it Harley, but that's what I happen to have.
Yeah.
It's so much like what we do in security. It's about getting things done, you know, setting it out at the end of the day where you can just park it up on its stand and nothing's broken.
Cool. Thanks very much for your time, Howard.
Gary, it's my pleasure. Thanks so much.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by Search Security. The March-April issue of IEEE S&P Magazine is a special issue on security training and education. The Silver Bullet interview features our chat with Dacient founder Neil Daswani, whose company was recently acquired by Twitter. Subscribe today at www.computer.org/security. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.